Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Hi.
Welcome, Archbishop.
Thank you.
Chinny, Martin, you. Justin, the Archbishop.
Justin.
We're going to be asking Justin some questions. And then when we've run out of questions, we're going to invite you to ask some questions. And there'll be a little place where you line up just down there in a few minutes. Welcome to Greenbelt. Thank you very
Thank
much
you very
for coming
much.
Along.
It's lovely to be here.
Tomorrow is the presentation of the every 2 year Michael Ramsey
three
book prize, every 3 years. And Justin and the other judges have read the 5 or 6 nominated books.
Yes.
And this afternoon they will go into a secret environment and decide which is the winner, which will be announced tomorrow.
Yes.
Have you read them all?
Yes.
You have? Do you already know what the winner is?
No.
Fair enough.
Well, we're going to start with some easier questions.
And if I did, I wouldn't tell you anyway.
We're going to start with some easier questions, some get-to-know-you questions, although I'm not sure you've done many interviews before, but I'm going to start you. Easy win, gently.
I'm really nervous about this.
Okay.
And,
Okay. The Lord be with you. What keeps you awake at night?
I didn't know we were going to do liturgy.
Sorry. What keeps you awake at night?
The church.
Is that like the bells from the local church?
No. It's bits of the church. I never worry about very much apart from the church.
Which bits?
I can't tell you that because I'd really be kept awake at night with what they wrote to me afterwards.
Now, the next question might have the same answer, because the next question is, what sends you to sleep in the day?
The church. different. I can sleep almost anywhere at any time except in bed at night. And that's been a very long-standing thing. I mean, you put me on a moving object and I fall asleep instantly. Cars, aeroplanes, trains, whatever, I just go to sleep. Put me in bed at night and I'm lying awake thinking about all the things that I should have thought about when I was asleep during the day.
Well, we've heard about your love for running backstage.
I hate running.
But you do it regularly.
I do it out of a sense of needing to make my life less pleasant.
But you've already said you're the Archbishop of Canterbury.
That was someone else making my life less pleasant.
So every morning you're up and running, where do you go?
Every weekday morning I get up at about 5:30, somewhere around that, 5:15. I know you're all up by then, but some of us need to sleep and I'm old. And then I go and spend a bit of time praying, and then I get the dog and we go down and go for a run, or at least I call it a run and the dog calls it a moderately fast walk. And I do that for about 30 minutes and hate it almost completely, and occasionally I run into a tree. Because it's very dark in the early morning, in winter.
I wonder, are you running around Lambeth, or are you running out on the streets? And what are you wearing? Do people stop you and say, oh, that's Archbishop of Canterbury, running?
It's a very personal question.
Sorry.
What am I wearing? I used to go out on the streets, and then I was discouraged from doing that by some people who said, by the security people, said they couldn't think of any reason to be worried at all, because there's no one who thinks I'm worth attacking. I'm really very harmless, and at least most people seem to think so, apart from those who work with me and the dog. And but they said, going out at the same time every morning on dark streets, we would sleep better at night if you didn't do that. So I run round and round the gardens round Lambeth Palace.
Okay.
And I go round and round and round. Yeah, was it round and round the garden like a teddy bear? Something like that.
So you've been doing this job for 6 years, I think, Archbishop.
Oh, Archbishop, yes. Yeah. Yes, I have, 6 and a half.
Yeah. Do you ever think, it's time for a change?
He's not pulling his punches. I mean, when are you going to resign? Is that what that means?
It's not an easy job, is it? You've already said
it's a wonderful job. It's a wonderful job. It's an absolutely amazing job. It's the biggest privilege to do it. You can't complain. If you're going to grumble about it, yeah, of course it keeps you awake at night. Everyone, how many people here never have anything that keeps them awake at night? One, right? Well done. Could you do a workshop later? If you want to know, it's the lady in the white T-shirt down there. Every job keeps you awake at night, and if it's not the job, it's family or the dog. But it's a huge privilege to do this job. It was a huge surprise to be offered it, invited to do it, and do I ever feel I want to stop? Of course I do, on bad days. Do I ever feel I should? No, not at the moment. Do the rest of the House of Bishops feel I should? Well, for all I know, very likely. They haven't told me yet. I'm sure they will. But I have to retire when I'm 70, which is in 26 years' time. And if you believe that, I've got some jobs I could offer you.
Okay, so let's talk a bit more about the church, as that is your thing. You get to see a lot.
Anyone got a pillow?
You get to see the best of the church and the worst of the church, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And you get to visit a lot of church services, for example. Are there visits that you make or churches that you see where you think, yes, this is exactly what church is supposed to be?
And yeah, when? Lots and lots and lots. And for all kinds of different reasons. It'll never be the same 2 weeks running. Sometimes it's always because there's a sense of community, because you get the sense that where you go and you're really built up, it's where you get the sense that people love one another and cope with each other and deal with each other being a pain in the neck. And where they're really, they belong to each other. And that's fantastic. And I see a lot of that in everything from tiny rural churches in my own diocese of Canterbury through to great big city centre churches with hundreds and hundreds of people. That sense of determination. And then the second thing I look for, which I see a huge amount, is engagement with the community. You know, the church generally in this country, not just Church of England, is more engaged with community now than it's been at any time, really, since the Second World War. Because so many things have stopped happening with the austerity years and with all that. We have to be engaged. We're engaged with looking after asylum seekers, with food banks, with night shelters, with debt counseling. We're engaged with a bunch of things we'd love not to have to be engaged with, because they're all signs of an unhealthy society. But we do it. We get stuck in. And at the same time, we're engaged. I'm just looking over there. We're engaged. So many churches engaged in issues around climate, great public issues, issues around reconciliation, issues around racism and division. I mean, it's everywhere. So most churches I go to, I'm very encouraged. Just occasionally, you come away and you think, oh, golly.
So you've just illustrated a narrative which is largely secret to a lot of people.
Yeah.
The dominant media narrative is this
we're
is
declining,
a joke,
we're finished.
History, and that's because that narrative is predicated on numbers. But numbers mean something, because without any numbers, you cannot do all that other work, can you?
No, you can't do. Bishop of Liverpool coined a phrase, bigger church for a bigger mission. And I think that really sums that up on why the numbers are there, are needed.
Why the numbers are needed?
Why we need people who are consumed with the love of God in Jesus Christ for creation, for the poor, for those without hope, for those in need, for other Christians. Thank you. I wasn't expecting that.
So there are, of course, people who are consumed with the love of Jesus Christ and all those other things personally, but yet they do not go to a church service or belong to a church community. And research shows that that's increasingly the case. What would you say to those people that church is for when they're disillusioned with church?
I mean, it's a surprise, surprise. It's a question that people raise quite a lot. I think the church has to be accepting. And the church is there to welcome those and to draw people together to be those who are God's people. When we have the Lambeth Conference next year, the book, the biblical book of the conference is 1 Peter. And in 1 Peter 2, Peter says, you are a holy nation, a royal priesthood, God's own people, whom he has called out of darkness into his marvelous light to proclaim the works of God. Now, if that's what the church is for, it's outward looking. It should be outward looking. It should be there in word and action to demonstrate that Jesus Christ came and lived in this world, that he was in fact God entirely as well as human entirely, that he died, he rose from the dead, he ascended into heaven, he sent the Holy Spirit so that we can be Christ to the world today. Now that's the job. That's what we're for. If you aren't involved in the body of Christ, you're not part of that 2-point-something-billion strong movement round the world that's doing that stuff for good or well. And that's what you're missing out on. And I think that's really sad.
You mentioned the Anglican Communion. You mentioned the Lambeth Conference next year. How has your role as the leader of that community informed your understanding of global inequality?
Incredibly. I mean, I'd spent a lot of time working in the communion in previous roles in the church, particularly in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, but also in the Far East, in the Middle East, other places. And a huge amount more since being in this role. I think, I mean, on next week, we're off to... I'm off with my wife. We're off to Sri Lanka to be with some of the bomb victims from the Easter Day bombings, and then South and North India to be with the Christians there and with others. And then later in the year, I'll be in the DRC, and my wife will be in the DRC separately a few days after we get back from India.
Yeah.
And when you go to South Sudan, DRC, let's give you an example. There's a fantastic program that Caroline's involved in, my wife Caroline is involved in, called Women on the Front Line. And who suffers most in war? It's almost invariably women, because they have to bury the dead, they're the refugees, they're attacked, they're violated in the most appalling and terrible ways. And we've done a lot of work in South Sudan. She's been there twice in the last 18 months, working with bishops' wives. In a country where there are almost no resources, which for 50 years, for the large part of 50 years, has been at war in one way or another, who gets the education? Well, very few people, and the ones who do are all men. And so when she goes and works with bishops' wives in South Sudan, and we find that 20-25% are literate, 75% are not literate, highly intelligent. They've just never been given a day's formal education. That tells you something about global inequality, about the fact that in really bad places of war, which is an awful lot of the world, or violence, or patriarchy, that huge chunks of the population are just set aside, don't matter. And it burns into your consciousness at every point. So when I went to something quite recently, I won't say what it was because it'd be a bit rude, but where it was all about wealthy global north people discussing about what they could do for the poor, ignorant global south. You just want to throw up.
So can I talk a bit more about that? Because I've heard that globally, an Anglican is more likely to look like me than you.
Yep.
And I wonder, when you're bringing together the Anglican Communion or for the Lambeth Conference, and you bring together all these different cultures, people from different places, what practically do you do, or can you do, to challenge this idea of kind of the global north as the ones with the power, the ones with enlightenment, and the global south as the ones in need of help or somehow less enlightened?
It's a really, really good question. The average Anglican is a woman in her 30s in sub-Saharan Africa on less than $4 a day with a 50% chance of being in a place of conflict or war, civil conflict or war. What can you do? Why do we bring together the Lambeth Conference? We bring them together first for encounter, because you only really understand that when you meet it. Secondly, it's not me who brings people together, I hope. I think it's God who brings people together. The church exists globally, never mind the Anglican Communion. The church exists globally because God created the church globally. And God's challenge to us is love one another. Not love one another who looks like you, but love one another, which means that we need to love those who are living in completely different circumstances with a totally different upbringing and an absolutely different approach to life. That's God's command. It's not my suggestion. And I've got to do that, and it's really, really difficult. But you have to encounter, you have to go there, you have to make yourself vulnerable. You have to accept, we have to start by accepting that we're likely wrong if we think we're powerful. Jean Vanier taught us that through the L'Arche communities, that actually the powerful, the so-called powerful, need the weak, who are really often the people that God has a preference for, a love for. When I was away, I've just come back from holiday. When I was away, one of the books I read was a book called Munich on the Nile, which is an account of when we gave independence to Sudan in the mid-50s by a British district commissioner, assistant district commissioner. Quite short. He calls it Munich on the Nile because when he wrote in the 50s, it was 16 years after the Munich crisis, where a British Prime Minister stood up and said, the Czechoslovak people, it's a faraway nation of which we know little, and we're not going to get involved in trying to help them. And that's what we did in the Sudan, and there's been 60 years of war. It's time we stopped saying we're powerful, wise, clever, rich, and started saying our trade system is corrupt, our commerce system is corrupt, the international financial system is unfair and corrupt. Our politics looks after ourselves. Our trade preference system makes it impossible for the poor to develop wealth. Our asylum system is unjust. Our immigration system is biased. But apart from that, we're doing pretty well.
Are you more able to say that or less able to say that because the church is part of the establishment?
I just did say it.
You did say it, yeah, I know, but we...
I'll
give you an example. When your predecessor, who obviously decided after 10 years, I did what I could, I'm standing down, I was struck that he now has a freedom to do the kind of things that someone in your position at the moment can't. You mentioned earlier 2.5 million people in the world, and you described them, 2.5 billion people, as a movement. I mean, another word for that is an institution, because institutions are quite difficult to change. And it might be possible to compare your work with the Lambeth, with the Anglican Communion, with Brexit. One wonders if this is it. I wonder if this product of colonial history, whether you should voluntarily say, game's up, we become weak, we give up our power.
Oh, sure. And so we say the game's up and turn round to the people in the global south and say, terribly sorry. Oh, thank you very much. That was a bit beyond my technical skills. And say, terribly sorry, you're on your own, mate. That sounds pretty Christian. We got a lot of concerns here. And we're not going to pay any attention to what Jesus said about sheep, or what Pope Francis says about smelling like the sheep, or what the Bible says about the church being a family. We're just going to say, sorry, mate, we're going to look after our own problems. There's a lot of people who want me to do that. Mm-hmm. They tend to be rich, white, and prosperous.
Mm-hmm. But do you think I'm spending a lot of time, we're spending a lot of time, on trying to keep together a communion of people around the world who kind of fundamentally disagree about a lot of stuff?
Oh, yeah, poor us. Poor us. What a hardship. Aren't we spending a lot of time trying to love our sisters and brothers in Christ, and they're trying to love us, and we're not really very good at it?
Okay, well, if you see it as a way to love your brothers and sisters in Christ, I get it.
And so that means we've got to reform the Anglican Communion.
Oh, now you're talking.
But not abandon it.
How would you reform it?
Well, I think there's quite a lot of things that over time, whether it's done in my time or not, because when you're dealing in 165 countries and there is no pope and there's no centre of authority,
yeah,
it's quite complicated and it takes a very long time. I think you understate what Rowan did. I think he did a pretty brilliant job with the communion.
Sure.
At a time of great difficulty.
Yeah.
And made it a lot easier for me. I think, how do we reform it? Well, one of the first things is we've got to, I would suggest at some point in the, before too long, we've got to try and make it possible for people who are not just citizens of the 16 realms of which the Queen is the monarch, to become Archbishop of Canterbury.
Mm-hmm.
So your choice would be for the whole communion, mm-hmm, and not just for a really quite small selection.
Yeah.
I mean, Rowan was from Wales, and that was seen as quite radical. I think, you know, there are some unbelievable, there are some fantastic people around the world, heroes who we never hear of, who suffer with their people and serve their people. And sure, it'd be very different having them leading the communion. They'd say a lot of things we really didn't like.
As Francis does.
As Francis does. But we've got to make progress in that direction, and we're trying to do that. And the way we're organising, I mean, the chair of the Lambeth Conference Planning Group is from South Africa, Archbishop Tabo. The majority of people on the planning group from the Global South. So it's going to...
You're on the way.
We're making progress, but it's slow, and there isn't any... There's inertia, there's not resistance.
I just want to talk... You mentioned it a bit, but climate change in particular adversely affects those from the Global South, those who are ones suffering from the corrupt systems, the corrupt economics, etc. We have our friends from Extinction Rebellion here, and some church leaders have spoken out in support of their civil disobedience. What do you think about that? What should the church's role be in tackling climate change?
Extinction Rebellion has coined a fantastic phrase, because it's a rebellion against the extinction of very large parts of the creation, and indeed a very large number of human beings over the next 80, 100 years. And with measures having to be taken to stop it, a huge amount in advance, and already for some things too late. It is the crisis for our children's generation and grandchildren's generation, and in many parts of the world for this generation, particularly in the South Pacific, in places like Bangladesh, where they're in the process of moving 250,000 people out of areas likely to flood imminently, already flooding. Yes, what should the church's response be? First, speak out very clearly. Pope Francis did that with Laudato Si. I wrote a book about last year and had a chapter on this there. The Church of England's been speaking very clearly about that and continues to do so, and will continue to do so. Secondly, act. You know, there's someone, a politician about 50 years ago, said the trouble with Church of England bishops in the House of Lords is they blow in, blow off, and blow out. In other words, lots of words, no action. It's very easy to say they should do X. The question is, what are we going to do?
So when it comes to action, should the church commissioners be divesting from the church commission?
The church commissioners should, in some circumstances, be divesting after engagement, yeah. The church commissioners are doing what is not being picked up. Church commissioners started something with the extractive industries about 4 years ago called Transition Pathway Initiative, TPI. Church commissioners run about 8 billion in investment, 8, 9 billion. That may sound a lot. It is a lot. Mm-hmm. But compared to world finance, that's nothing.
It's a drop in a rising ocean.
The TPI... The church commissioners started using the leverage of being the church to get other fund managers together around the world. And today, people running investments worth $32 trillion. That's 32 apples. They are on board on the Transition Pathway Initiative. Now, that is the sum of money where when you ring up the head of Shell, or when they ring up the head of Shell, I don't get involved personally because one or two other things do. When they ring up the head of Shell says, yes, when would you like to come in? Because $32 trillion is a lot of money. So action, use the investments. Don't just walk away, because that's not going to change anything. Walk away if they won't change, but try and leverage the investments to make change. Thirdly, what are we doing with our buildings? Are we going to put solar panels? Are we going to find ways of generating power for our buildings that do not despoil the environment and so on and so forth? What are we doing at a local level on the ground to demonstrate to people that this is really important and worth putting money into. So action and words. It's no use just words.
Sure.
You talked about the church's role in tackling climate change. What about our role in the B word, which keeps me up at night, Brexit? What can we do about it? You said that you voted Remain, I think.
I said that what?
You voted Remain.
Yes, I did.
What should we do about it? It's a mess.
First of all, we have to take seriously the fact that the majority voted to leave. We may not like it. Some people may not like it. But that's democracy. It was 52-48 or something like that. And that means that we're leaving. So let's stop whinging about it and do something about reuniting the country.
But, yeah, what should we do about the division?
What should we... And secondly, we have to ask why there's the division. I think Brexit was a lightning conductor. People wanted to leave. That goes back a long way in our history. But more than that, look at where the places that people voted to leave were lots of places that I've lived in and worked in. They were voting in 2008-09 in the Great Recession. The government of the day, under Gordon Brown, found itself compelled to rescue the banks with £250 billion. The coal mines closed down where 1% of that would have recreated jobs in that area. Now, if you care about the environment, you don't want to mine coal. But you don't want to leave the vast majority of people who were mining coal still unemployed, because that debases human dignity. And yet, when the banks go, the money's there, and a lot of people just feel a deep sense of inequality and injustice. So first of all, the church has to say something about inequality and injustice. Secondly, we have to act on that. Thirdly, reconciliation is almost too early to talk about now because people are so deeply enmeshed in the division. But trying to create ways of having good deliberation, of actually enabling people to disagree well, is something the church has done for centuries and can do really well, to disagree really robustly and well. Citizens' forums, local meetings, parish level, diocesan level, national level. The kind of reuniting behind a common vision for this country, which must be outward-looking and committed to justice around the world, which at our best many of us have been, is in history, is done through top-down, middle-out, bottom-up. And the church is one of those institutions that is at all three levels and can do that. And that's what we're doing at the moment. We're not... Sorry, it's a double negative. We are doing quite a lot. A lot of it is not visible, because a lot of this sort of stuff is getting people into rooms who don't want others to know that they've been meeting together. Because if they did, they'd get death threats.
Thank you. We should probably start to get people ready to ask questions for the mic. I don't know if Lucy's going to organise that. While people are getting to the mic, did you have one more?
Yes.
Go on then.
Just a small one. Where is the church and where are you on human sexuality? A lot of the people here, a lot of our friends from Greenbelt have been hurt by the church. What would you say to them?
The most recent stories are very powerful. The most recent story about partners and the Lambeth Conference, it was very surreal reading it, thinking... I remember a long time ago when my eldest son was 13, he saw a news report on the telly about gay priests and the Church of England Zoo, and he said to me, "Dad, that's not our church, is it?" And I said, "It's not our church, but it is the Church of England." Often this is kind of weird. Mm. You think, really? What are these people living in our day and age? Do you ever feel that yourself?
putting on a strange hat, weird robes, and saying things in 17th century English quite a lot of the time, I can't imagine why I wouldn't feel we were living in our day and age.
But do you ever think the messages the church sends out must feel just strange and weird to say young people?
Yeah, I do. Like, yeah, of course.
People's attitudes have changed so dramatically, haven't they? And the church feels way back.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. First of all, I haven't got a good answer to the question. I hope I'll have a better answer after the Lambeth Conference, but I haven't got a good answer.
It's time for change. God wants every single one of us just as we are. The church is being inclusive and to include every single person. We are all worthy of God's love.
Thank you.
I entirely agree.
Come up to the mic and we'll take a question.
Okay, guys, so we're going to go to some questions.
Can I answer the question?
Yeah.
May I answer the question?
Yeah.
Because I was just starting to answer the question just then. And I think it's one of the most important questions we're facing in the church in this country. In the 2008 Lambeth Conference, no bishop in same-sex relationships was permitted to come, so particularly Gene Robinson. Mm-hmm. When it came 2020, why wasn't it 2018? Because of we were too disunited on issues of human sexuality. When it came 2018, I took the decision that every bishop in the Anglican Communion, whatever their views, whatever their sexuality, whether they were in a same-sex marriage or not, should be invited. They were invited, and they are coming. I then faced the question of what do we do with their spouses? And the answer, remember, I'm not a pope, I don't make the doctrine of the Anglican Communion. The answer is very straightforward, that it was a choice of exclusion. I asking bishops in same-sex relationships has already meant that a significant number of bishops with different views, and I agree entirely, everyone is loved by Christ, whatever their view on this, whatever their position, whether they hold a view that you disagree with or a view you agree with, they're all equally loved. When it became known that I'd invited bishops in same-sex relationships, there was a huge outcry from large parts of the church, and significant numbers of bishops said they wouldn't be able to come. Secondly, if I had invited the spouses, so I pushed it, as far as I can see, with 6 years' experience of travelling around the communion and having gone to every province, I pushed it as far as I could if we're to have a Lambeth Conference. The Lambeth Conference of 1998 set the rules for the Anglican Communion. Only a Lambeth Conference can change the rules for the Anglican Communion. We're not an imperialistic, colonialist power. In England, we can't say, look here, you poor ignorant chaps in the global south, you're going to have to do what we tell you. That's what we've always done. I'm trying to get away from that. If I'd asked the spouses, I'd have excluded 300-400 spouses from the global south. And I've talked about South Sudan. Many of them oppressed, neglected, for whom a Lambeth Conference is their only chance in their lifetimes to come to somewhere where they're treated as precious and valuable. And I would have probably, quite likely, meant there wasn't a Lambeth Conference that could address the question of what we believe and how we act. And we're going to address that question because we are having a Lambeth conference. If there isn't a Lambeth conference, we can't address the question. The other part of your question, and so I have to make sure there's a Lambeth conference. Every single person who's coming is loved by God. And we need to love them, whether we agree with them or disagree with them. Secondly, what do I think about it? Well, I am entirely in agreement that Christ died for every single human being, and their sexuality is no more significant than any other aspect. Every human being's a sinner equally. Every single one of us needs Christ's forgiveness through his death on the cross and his resurrection and new life. That is clear. I am indifferent as to people's sexuality in terms of whether they're loved by God and therefore should be loved by me. What I have the difficult task of doing, and it's one of the two most difficult, the other being abuse, is ensuring that by loving and caring for one group, I don't exclude and hate another group or give them the feeling they are excluded and hated, particularly when they are victims, poor and neglected already. That's the issue I'm trying to deal with.
And just a reminder, questions, no statements, no sermons, questions. Thank you.
This follows quite nicely from what you've just been saying. Before you, Nadia Boltz-Weber was here talking about sex and the church and how the church has made people feel bad. The Church of England has been under quite some inspection around that over the last year. I'm from Chichester Diocese. We feel that particularly.
Yeah.
Words like reparation and reconciliation were mentioned in her session. Is it time for a truth and reconciliation commission around that issue for the church so we actually do something rather than just write reports?
If you're happy to, I'd love to know. I'd love people to say their name when they ask a question. If you're not, that's fine.
Martin Poole, I'm a vicar in Brighton.
Martin, it's very nice. I'm very glad you asked the question. First of all, can I say Chichester Diocese has had to face this more acutely than anyone else. Secondly, thanks to the people who are leading the diocese and to the diocese and the clergy and the laity today, you've done it better than most, so thank you. Secondly, reparations and reckons. Do we need a TRC? We're going to need a TRC, but it's not for the offenders to tell the survivors. It's time we reconciled. It's for us to say we are humiliated, appalled, and despairing of what the church did. When you're willing to talk about reconciliation, tell us the terms on which you're willing to do it.
Thank you. Okay. Can I ask the young woman to ask the next question? We'll just
Hi, I'm Isaac.
Hang on.
Isaac.
Can I ask this young lady to ask the question first, please?
Okay.
And then you can come next. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Katie Godini, and I have a question about the Holy Trinity Brompton HTB church planting program, which is expansive and well-funded in this country, and what the impact you think that has on the Church of England, that they have a particular model that is then introduced and planted into other churches in England and now into Wales as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, I'm not the best person to answer the question. I went to HDB before I was ordained, but that was a very long time ago. And I've been back there perhaps 7 or 8 times, 10 times in the last 30 years. The church planting, first of all, church planting, the financing for church planting done by HDB comes from principally from HDB and from local dioceses. Secondly, the opportunities to plant are open to all churches, and I really encourage people to plant. Thirdly, what's the impact? They do have a particular model, but the model tends, in my experience, and I haven't attended a church plant, tends to adapt itself in different parts of the country. They only plant with consent. Some of their plants are really good. I'm sure some of them don't work. That's the normal experience of church planting. But there's far more church planting going on than HDB is doing. I think by 2030, we have planned at the moment a bit short of 3,000 church plants, of which I think HDB is, we're talking probably 40 or 50, if that. I may be completely wrong, or perhaps 100, let's guess. I think that is one model that is really good. It takes with it particular values. I was struck by a church that I was seeing in East London quite recently, just in an area where there'd been a lot of stabbing and shooting. They were really engaged in the community with the Islamic community. They were a plant of a plant from HDB. It was all local people. It was growing in numbers. It was deeply committed to the community. And the archdeacon, who's not from that tradition, took me aside afterwards and he said, you know, I don't like their style of worship, but I can tell you I've never met such a generous church. Okay. I want generous churches. Great. I don't care what tradition they come from. I want churches that aren't trying simply to reproduce themselves and get their own empires bigger. I want churches that are just want to give to the national church out of what God has given to them. And if that's Anglo-Catholic, if it's liberal, if it's HDB, if it's conservative, I don't care. Let's just get on with it.
Okay.
Because the churches don't have enough people in.
Thank you. Thank you. We're going to take the next three all together, please. So one after the other, quite quick. You can remember all that.
So I'm Isaac. I'm actually involved in the Extinction Rebellion. And you mentioned in your talk the importance of action and not words. As a young Christian, I'm actually really scared about the future of our planet. We have with us some letters from children and families in our parishes asking you to make a stand on the climate emergency because the church needs leadership now. So firstly, would you please accept these letters?
Yeah. Chuck them over here.
Yes.
Oh, here we go.
And secondly, would you personally be prepared to make an official statement of support for Christians who are taking action in the September school strike and the October Extinction Rebellion? And will you be there yourself?
Thank you. Hold on the answer. Next question.
Rebel on, Isaac. My question is, thank you for your talk and your time here.
What's your name?
Kathy. Question is, in answer to Tina's question, you were talking about the church is here to be accepting of people disillusioned with it. I want to know, with the changes in the Global South, Botswana going for equal marriage, Kenya's kind of on the way there. I want to know, when is equal marriage coming to the Church of England?
Thank you. Next one.
I'm Steve Hucklesby. I work with the Methodist Church and I'm a member of the Church of England. The Worldwide Anglican Communion, we've talked a little bit about, they've for a long time had a very clear position on nuclear weapons. They are opposed to nuclear weapons. Over the next 10 years, it's forecast that around $1 trillion US dollars equivalent will be spent on nuclear weapons around the world, which Pope Francis has described as theft from the poor. The church in the UK has been, the Anglican Church in the UK has maybe been a little bit slow in this area, but recently at General Synod has commended
what's the question?
Coming to the question now, has commended the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. How would you like the Church of England to follow through on that General Synod resolution?
Thank you.
That's three questions. Extinction Rebellion, will I take letters? It's a privilege. Thank you very much. What's the date? Where's Isaac gone?
20th.
20th of September. I can't guarantee to be there. I think I'm probably travelling, but that... will I make a public statement? I'm not going to give a snap answer on that. I'll think about it and consult with colleagues to make it more effective if we do, so it's not just me. We don't tend to do things... I'm not a pope. I don't do things by myself. Kenya is not moving towards equal marriage. Their Supreme Court has just said it's against their constitution. When will there be equal marriage in the Church of England? I'll give you a very honest answer. I have no idea. And it's not for me to make the decision. It's for the Church and the General Synod. And the General Synod would need a two-thirds majority to make that decision. And that is something. There are General Synod elections next year, 2020. Get out there and vote. Whichever you want. Steve, on nukes, yeah, we're a bit slow. We made our first major statement on nuclear weapons in 1982 when we came out and said they were immoral. And that position has not changed since then. General Synod restated it quite recently. It's always been something that I've said in public. What should the Church do? Continue to support those who are against nuclear weapons. The General Synod's taken that view. It's always been a view that weapons of mass destruction, not just nukes, but biological, chemical, and for that matter, quite possibly, we have to ask really hard questions about robotic warfare and artificial intelligence in warfare, which is coming, and why that might be moral under any circumstances. But yes, I admire the courage of those who served in our armed forces. I come from a family with lots of members of the armed forces. I'm not a pacifist. I've seen lots of war, and I'm still not a pacifist. But the use of nuclear weapons is simply wrong on every kind of Christian teaching since Augustine.
Thank you. Three more. Quick as we can, we've got about 10 minutes.
Good morning, my name is Paul Hubb and I'm from Retford, I'm an Anglican. Can you tell me what your opinion is on the issue of the oppression of the Palestinian people, and is that something that you are able to speak publicly about, or do you take a more expedient view of not wanting to upset people in the UK?
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Sally. Can you tell us how you pray?
Thank you.
Badly.
Concise.
Hello, I'm Martin. I'm from West Yorkshire, one of the coal mining areas that you spoke about earlier. The Anglican church that I attend is in Birstall, which is 300 metres away from where Joe Cox was assassinated. She's given me tremendous inspiration to fight against Brexit. The 52-48% was a vote, but it was a vote based on lies. Cambridge Analytica distorted social media. It was dishonest. It must be reversed. Must be a people's vote or Article 15 must be revoked.
What's the question?
When will you stand up against the liars such as Boris Johnson and publicly state it was wrong? It's not just... there was a vote. The vote was wrong.
Thank you.
What was the first one?
Second one was about prayer.
What was the first one?
Nuclear.
No. Now I've done nuclear.
Palestine.
What?
Palestine.
Palestine. Thank you. I knew it was important. I'll say what I've always said, and what we've said publicly. And I've worked in that area for many, 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 many years. and feel very strongly about it. The state of Israel is a legitimate state recognized in international law and therefore has the same rights and obligations as every other legitimate state in the world. Amongst those rights are the right to security from attack and to peaceful life. The Palestinian people have a right to justice in land, to not having their land taken from them illegally under international law. And it has been agreed many years ago that there should be a two-state solution in which the Palestinian people would also have the rights and obligations of a state, the right to peaceful existence and the obligation of not starting fighting anywhere else. The moment we lose one side or other of that, we lapse into saying the wrong thing. We are facing the biggest upsurge in anti-Semitism that we have seen in this country since the Second World War. It's up more than 300%. We're also seeing the same thing with Islamophobia and hatred of all minorities. It's not just from the right, it's from the left, it's from the middle, it's from all parties, it's in all areas. We have to be really, really careful about what we say because we're dealing with people's lives and their futures. On Palestine, yeah, the church has said many, many times they have a right to justice on land and justice in the way they are treated. And Israel has a right to live in peace and security. It's easy to say, how do we get from here to there has defeated the best diplomats, the best minds, and the best people for the last 50 years, not just in the last 10 or so, including Barack Obama, who was deeply committed to getting that. So that's my answer on that one. Secondly, how do I pray? I pray in every single way that I see other people praying and that they meet with God in Jesus Christ. So I pray silently in front of the sacrament in contemplation and adoration. I pray in using forms of charismatic forms of prayer. I pray with intercession. I pray with thanksgiving. I pray with other people. I pray by myself. I pray with the Bible. And I try and learn each day to pray more. Thirdly, the Brexit vote. Well, it was a blunt question, I'll give a blunt answer. I came out before the vote and said, I'm intending to vote Remain. I said, people have to make up their own minds. I didn't tell people how to vote. I don't do that. And I got into a lot of trouble of not being forgiven him yet by criticizing Mr. Farage at the time of the campaign for some of the things he was saying, and so did the rest of the Church of England. And we were very clear then, we're still very clear, but it is not for us to take sides in a political dispute. We're political, but we're not party political. We need to seek the common good. And there are very different views. Look at the polls. Far more people are deeply committed, not just slightly persuaded, deeply committed to one side or another than on any other issue. It's about 84% of people have strong views on Brexit, and it's about 50-50. That's the average of the polls over the last month. There isn't an obvious way forward except to stop insulting each other and to learn to seek the common good. Can Britain prosper outside the European Union? Yes. Can they prosper within the European Union? Yes. Is the European Union faultless? Utterly not. Is some sort of inward-looking little Englander, approach a good approach? No, it's not. Do I know how we move forward on this? No, I don't. But I'm a Democrat. We voted, and I'm sticking. And if the House of Commons votes for a fresh vote, that's up to the House of Commons.
You would be looking for a two-thirds majority.
Great, it would have been wonderful 3.5 years ago, but we didn't. It was 50% plus one, and that's what we got. And history is history. We looked for almost a two-thirds majority on Scottish independence, and in the first referendum they had on it many years ago, and they didn't get it.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm really sorry to the people who have been waiting, but we have actually run out of time. I wonder if you could just leave us with a few words of hope that we can go from here with.
Two things. About 4 years ago, I went to a refugee camp in, as it happens, in Congo. For reasons I didn't understand at the time and still don't understand now, the World Food Programme and others had stopped supplying it. And so they were very, very short of food, very hungry indeed. There was a tent with one doctor in it, tent perhaps half this size, with one doctor in it, and children with disabilities lying on the floor. It was a volcanic area, so it was lava rock. They were lying on the ground, not even on mattresses, unchanged. There was no one really to look after them. They were kids with disabilities, learning disabilities, physical disabilities, who'd been abandoned on the road because their parents couldn't care for them. There were 25,000 other people. I remember a little baby who was being looked after by a four-year-old, five-year-old, her sister. And the baby was dying. She died very shortly afterwards. She obviously had severe learning difficulties. I remember a woman in her 60s, 70s, I don't know, I'm guessing, who had gone blind. And I sat with her for a while, and she just wept and wept and wept and said, I can't see, I've got no food. I don't know where my family is. When we get together at a place like this, and I can walk out here and I don't need security, or they're very kind and provide it, but nobody is going to shoot me. When nobody's likely to put a bomb here, when we all get lunch in a few minutes when I stop talking, and all those things, and you look at them, you think, well, there's no hope there. And they're the people who will be killed by climate change long before we are. And at the end of it, the bishop there said to me, say something to give them some hope. I didn't know what to do, so I did what archbishops do when they don't know what to say, which is they talk for a while. And I started off by quoting Hebrews, Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. It was translated into the local language. And this crowd that had gathered, because they had nothing else to do really, see this stupid little tubby white man, this crowd cheered and started singing one of the songs of the East African revival. Why do we have hope? Because as Paul says to the Thessalonians when he's talking about bereavement, you don't grieve as others do. Yes, we grieve, but we have hope because Jesus Christ is risen from the dead. And that is what means that in the end, the deepest darkness is always conquered, that God always prevails. And that if we as Christians, with all our muddles and failures, hesitations about what we say in public and the rest, if we put our shoulders to the wheel together, if we learn to love one another and stop saying they're not real Christians because X, Y, or Z, or they're a long, long way away and I don't know much about them, so they don't really count. And that's not a Greenbelt attitude, by the way. It's other places. If we as Christians do that, we become the hope. And unless you're the hope, I'm never going to be the hope. And I, even if I completely screw up from beginning to end, you are still the hope. Because the Spirit of Jesus Christ lives in you, and you have the call and power of the mission of God to change this world. That's why there's hope.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.